Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. I'm sure some of you are a little surprised I did one episode, but I'm actually going to try and follow up and do some more and keep it going at a steady pace, so hopefully I can keep doing that. So hopefully this is a good start to a full episode and doing more episodes once each week and doing them for a long time. Well, I forgot to borrow Creationism's Trojan Horse this week from the library, so we're not going to talk about that this week. Instead, I chose a different topic, which hopefully will make this episode more true to the name of the podcast, The Big Bang and Creationism. Now, before I start, I wanted to mention that a few days ago, it was found that protein extracted from a Tyrannosaurus rex bone provided proof of the evolutionary relationship between the T-Rex and the modern chicken. This has been hailed a great affirmation of a claim made by many evolutionary scientists that birds are modern descendants of dinosaurs. Now, of course, Answers in Genesis, a major creationist kind of website, has already tried to dispute this by claiming that the similarity in the amino acid sequences in the protein of the dinosaur was only 58% similar with that of the chicken, so they say it's not close enough. They do mention, however, that the chicken was the closest match on the database, but that, since the database hasn't logged all of the animals in existence, some of the animals not listed could be a closer link. And I agree, this is a very good possibility that some of the creatures not listed could be better related to the Tyrannosaurus rex than the chicken. But the chicken's the best match in the entire database. It doesn't seem like this is a really valid reason to dispute the claim. I mean, humans could really not be related to apes. We could simply just be related to a relative we haven't found yet that could have a closer similarity to us. But it's not in our database yet, so therefore we shouldn't make the deduction that apes and humans are related. Obviously, this is a bad argument. And so is the one Answers in Genesis is making here. The chicken is the closest matching relative to the Tyrannosaurus rex, and in this entire database of animal, that doesn't list all of the organisms there are. Well, obviously, deducing that the chicken is the best match is what we can do, and if we were to assume that we haven't found all the animals yet, therefore we can make no conclusions, we could draw no links between anything, and it would be impossible to do any kind of science based on genetic relationship. So moving on from this little aside about the news, the topic this week is going to be about geometry and how it affects the evolution of our universe. But first, I want to touch on a creationist claim that I've dealt with many times and I had to deal with over spring break. But I hear this a lot from creationists, and it's not specifically a creationist claim about evolution, but it's more in regards to science as a whole and the nature of what science is. It goes something like this: science is always changing. So which would you rather put your faith into? Something that's always changing, or something that is forever, like God? And the basic gist of this statement is that science's changing nature means that we can't know anything for sure in science, which is true, and thus there's no reason to accept the findings of science because they could change the next day. Instead, we should trust in a being that cannot change, which they say is their God. Now, there are a lot of problems with this statement. One most important being is that it's a false dichotomy. It's not God or evolution. Plenty of scientists exist in the middle ground. Take Ken Miller, for instance. He's a Christian. But he's also a major critic of intelligent design. In fact, you can go look on YouTube for a video he did, for a recording of a presentation he gave in a church, about why intelligent design is not science and what exactly is wrong with specifically the notion of irreducible complexity when applied to biological systems like the bacteria flagellum. So there are Christians who are also evolutionists. I'm hesitant to use the phrase evolutionist, but everyone knows what it means, so I'll just use it. There are many Christian evolutionists, and so saying this, there's this dichotomy between God and evolution, it really does not exist, but creationists would like to think there is one like that. They try to make people take one side or the other. And people, of course, don't want to get rid of their God, so they're going to try to refuse to accept evolution based on this dichotomy. So this question is just assuming God is a fundamentalist Christian version of God, too. It doesn't mention any other God. It's just the creationist version of God, who wants everyone to believe in a 6,000-year-old earth. And obviously, there are many other different conceptions of what God is. Now, secondly, the changing nature of science is what allows us to learn something about the natural world. The reason science can change is because all of the theories must be verifiable by observation. If what we observe doesn't match the theory, we must discard the theory or change it until it does fit, until it makes sense. That's the beauty of science. That's what science is. Without this changing, falsifiable nature, we couldn't know anything about the natural world, because our theories would exist outside of the realm of testing. If we can't falsify it, then observation is meaningless. So the whole notion of observational science goes out the window. That's what tests science, that's what shows that our theories are correct, is we can observe them in the natural world. And if we can't falsify them, if there's no possible way to falsify them, then it's outside of the realm of testing, and we can't do anything about it. People can make arbitrary claims. And this is where the whole notion of the supernatural not being allowed into science comes in. Many creationists I've talked to say, well, if we get rid of all the natural explanations, why can't we use the supernatural one? As if you could deduce that we've looked at all the possibilities in the natural realm, we can suddenly jump to the supernatural. Well, there's a problem with this. First of all, we can't get rid of all the natural explanations. Even if all the ones we know don't work, that doesn't mean we can jump into something that's totally arbitrary. For instance, you know, we don't know right now how consciousness works exactly. Does that mean we can suddenly say that it is a soul inside of us? I'm not saying there's a problem with the notion of the soul. I'm saying it's not a scientific explanation for anything. You can't falsify the notion of the soul because the soul is not testable in any kind of way. It's not falsifiable, and science is based off of that falsifiability. You can claim the soul, I can claim the tooth fairy, I can claim Santa Claus, I can claim any kind of thing I want to, and you can never prove me wrong. So the beauty of science is that you can prove things wrong. Now please don't mistake that I'm not trying to be anti-religious. I'm just stating that when we try to compare the explanatory power of, say, God or anything else supernatural with that of science, God falls drastically short in that all the claims made about him are totally unverifiable. So they can't be subject to scrutiny or rigorous testing. And when we use a supernatural explanation, any explanation will work, and we can use that explanation for any kind of question. You ask how the sun was there. Well, God made it, or something else supernatural created it. How does gravity work? Well, it's not really gravity, you see. It's this God thing pulling stuff down to the earth. Well, you can make as many arbitrary claims about this thing as you want, and we can't prove you wrong, because it's outside of the realm of observation. I can't actually touch your claim. It's untouchable. So, using the supernatural in science, it doesn't work that way. It's excluded by the nature of science. It's not science being biased, which is what a lot of creationists seem to think. Science isn't biased against the supernatural. It just has to work. The only way it can work is in the realm of naturalism. It's not that naturalists or all the scientists are atheists who want to get rid of explanations, including God. Well, God isn't an explanation. We have to do things in the natural realm. And I could go on rambling about this for a long time, but it just saddens me to hear this so often, that this distrust in science is really appalling. Scientists are people who want to discover facts about the world and how it works. And it's too often assumed that these people have some sort of agenda to push, be it evolution or global warming or the Big Bang or just naturalism in general. The statement said above, the creationist statement, makes it clear that many people think that trusting in something that's evidentially verifiable is a bad thing because that evidence may shift the presiding view. Things may change based on what we observe. Well, I say it's better to be wrong about science, but to have an opinion based on the facts, than to start with something that isn't an answer at all, like the supernatural, and claim it is the answer to every single thing simply because you say so and you make arbitrary claims about it. The natural realm and the explanatory power of science is much greater than any supernatural thing anyone can come up with. And that's the creationist claim for this week. Now, as I said before, the topic for this week, the main discussion topic for this week, is going to be about the geometry of the universe. So we're going to be doing a lot of math here. And you might want to get out a pen and a piece of paper or a pencil and try to follow along, because some of these concepts are a little hard to grasp. It took me a while to understand, especially the non-Euclidean geometry. I'll explain that term in a second. It just took me a little time to try and understand how these things worked. And if you don't get it, I'd suggest, you know, Google searching. I'll try to include some images on the post I make on the blog, but aside from that, it's going to be left to kind of your imagination or your ability to kind of use the internet to browse and try to find pictures of these things to try and make sense of them, because they are, I will admit, a little difficult to understand. So the shape of our universe has a very profound effect on the evolution of the universe, how the universe is going to change over time. So knowing the geometry of the universe can help us understand what will happen in the future. So we're going to start off with a brief tour of the various geometries that there exist that could explain the universe and the shape of the universe, and then we're going to move on from there into the effects on the universe. Now, I know I kind of covered the geometry of the universe a bit in an earlier episode a while back, but I figure this can kind of be a refresher and a little more in-depth explanation of the various geometries and how they affect the shape of the universe and how they affect the evolution of the universe. So we're going to be dealing with two different kinds of geometry, Euclidean and non-Euclidean. Euclidean geometry was invented by a Greek mathematician named Euclid. He wrote a book called Elements, which is the very first book discussing the notion of geometry. It's a group of smaller sub-books that begin with a set of axioms, about five, and then the proofs go from there to demonstrate the validity of various propositions that Euclid makes in his geometry. I tried getting through Elements. I read it a while back, or tried to read it, that is, but I was really bored. It might have been just because I didn't like the math at the time, or because it was really boring. But I might give it a try once more if I ever have the time, but it's a really long book, and all of it is just going through various proofs based on the axioms that Euclid proposes in the beginning of his book. Euclid started with a total of five axioms in his geometry, but only one's of real importance to us. The others, they wouldn't really affect our discussion on the shape and evolution of the universe. This axiom is known as the parallel postulate, and it states that if you have two lines that cross a third in such a way that the sum of the inner angles is less than 180 degrees, in other words, less than two right angles, then the two lines have to intersect at some distance. Now, again, the best way to wrap your mind around this is to either look for a picture or to draw one yourself. Unless the third line can be perpendicular to both other lines, then some sort of crossing is going to occur for those first two lines at some point. This is a simple statement about parallel lines. Parallel lines always maintain the same distance apart from one another in Euclidean geometry. Otherwise, the sum of those inner angles would be less than 180. Again, draw it out if you don't believe me or you're having trouble picturing this. Euclidean geometry is the geometry we all learned about in high school, and the same geometry we all had to do those annoying proofs for. I remember doing those, I think it was my freshman year, trying to draw out those proofs. I had a lot of trouble doing that, and I know a lot of other people did. But this is the geometry we learned about in high school, and I don't think we even touched on the other two non-Euclidean geometries because those are a little more abstract and difficult to wrap your mind around. Now, the application of Euclidean geometry to the universe seems pretty apparent from observation. Looking around us, things just seem to fit with Euclidean geometry. In fact, that's how Euclid could claim his axioms were right. They just seem to be obvious from our observations. But the fifth postulate, the parallel postulate made by Euclid, wasn't exactly as obvious to the ancient Greeks, even to the ancient Greeks when Euclid proposed it, but it wasn't as obvious as the other postulates, the axioms. And the problem with this was, well, at first you're thinking, how is there a problem with this? It seems to make perfect sense. So what's wrong with it? And the reason mathematicians found it less appealing than the others is because verifying it as a physical fact would require the seemingly impossible test of following two lines out to some infinite distance to make sure that they crossed or not. The other axioms, however, seemed to follow from one another, and they were all pretty straightforward. And many people tried to determine the validity of the fifth axiom by proving it from the other four. But none of the proofs that were ever made were sound proofs. That is, we couldn't use any of these proofs to demonstrate the validity of the fifth axiom from the others. So here's where we enter in with non-Euclidean geometry. Non-Euclidean geometry is any geometry that isn't Euclidean, or, and to say it in a more meaningful way, non-Euclidean is any geometry that doesn't obey the parallel postulate. These are known as hyperbolic and elliptical geometries. Both of these geometries were discovered a long time after Euclid had discovered his, only a few centuries before the present time. They were looked at before that, but the only reason they were looked at was to kind of try and disprove them and therefore validate the parallel postulate. Now, despite the strange properties these geometries have, they may in fact be the correct geometry of the overall universe, in spite of what common sense may tell some of us. Let's take a look first at hyperbolic geometry, and then we'll kind of go over elliptical geometry, but it's pretty much the same and opposite of the hyperbolic geometry. Hyperbolic geometry was looked into about a millennium ago in an attempt to discredit hyperbolic geometry itself and thus prove the parallel postulate of Euclid's. Unfortunately, as we now know, we weren't able to do that, and in fact, it was proven that we could not prove the parallel postulate from the other four axioms of Euclid's. In the 19th century, hyperbolic geometry was looked into again, this time as an actual possibility for real geometry. For comparison, we're just going to discuss what happens to parallel lines in this geometry, so that we have a simple basis for comparison. I don't want to overly complicate things and tell you all the details about hyperbolic geometry, and also, I don't know all the details about hyperbolic geometry, so this is the easiest way for both me and everyone else, I think, I would hope, to wrap our minds around hyperbolic geometry and how it compares to the geometry we all know and love, which is Euclid's geometry. In hyperbolic geometry, two parallel lines will diverge from one another. There's going to be a closest point, but then the ends get infinitely far away from each other. They kind of curve away from each other. And despite this fact that these lines curve away from each other, they can both be connected by a single line that is perpendicular to them both at any point. And again, me saying this, you're probably wondering, you know, what is this guy talking about? And I'll post some links to the website, and, you know, again, Google search, you can find a lot of good stuff on Google that kind of helps you envision what this is, because, again, I had a hard time figuring it out myself. So, and now, ignoring a different class of parallel lines in this geometry, because there are two different classes of parallel lines, ones are hyperparallel and the other is ultraparallel, we find that there are two possible parallel lines through a single point that are parallel to a different line. Now, contrast this with Euclidean geometry. If you have a line and there's a point that's not on a line, there's only one line you can draw through that point that would be parallel to the first line. In Euclidean geometry, it is saying there are two different lines that you can draw through that one single point that will be parallel to your first line. So you can have up to, you'll have three lines in this image instead of two with Euclidean geometry. You'll have two parallel lines to a single line through the same point. It's very bizarre. Now, one other odd property of hyperbolic geometry that follows from this parallel line postulate is that the sum of the angles in a triangle will add up to less than 180 degrees. In Euclidean geometry, we all know that a triangle, the sum of the angles, inner angles in a triangle, will always add up to 180 degrees. In this hyperbolic geometry, they will always add up to less. And again, go take look for an image of this picture yourself. It's difficult to picture when me I just say it and you're trying to envision my words. It's just really bizarre. So moving on from hyperbolic geometry, elliptical geometry is just the opposite. While there are two parallel lines for every line in hyperbolic geometry, there are no such things as parallel lines in the entire elliptical geometry. These lines end up forming great big circles which eventually cross paths. Now, the sum of the angles in a triangle in elliptical geometry is, unlike hyperbolic geometry, it's going to be greater than 180 degrees. And before dwelling too long on geometry, we'll see how each of these geometries might be present in a universe, in our universe, and see how they would affect things. Now, the best way to imagine this 180-degree triangle in elliptical geometry is to envision the Earth. This is an example I've heard a lot of times that will probably help you envision how these triangles can have greater than 180 degrees. If you start with, say, a globe, you can take two perpendicular lines at the very top of the object, at, say, the north pole of the Earth, and you draw two lines that are at 90-degree angles with one another. And then you draw these lines down until they connect with, say, the equator. That'll be our third line. That'll be the bottom of the triangle. Now, looking at the two new angles you just created by connecting these two lines to the equator, you're going to see that the sum of all these angles is going to be greater than 90 degrees, so the sum of the total angles of the entire triangle is going to be 90 degrees, the top angle you made, plus the two, which are going to sum up to greater than 90 degrees. So in the end, you're going to have a triangle with greater than 180 degrees total. So again, do this yourself, test it out. I'm sure it works. I've tried it myself, but again, hard to envision, so I would suggest doing this experiment on your own. So, how does this all apply to the universe? How does the geometry of the universe affect the shape and evolution of the universe? Well, the geometry of the universe is intricately linked to the amount of mass in the universe. That is, the presence of mass is going to distort, or is going to increase or decrease, depending on how much there is, the strength of the gravity for the entire universe. And if the gravity is strong enough to halt or even reverse the expansion of the universe that we're experiencing now, the universe is going to end in a big crunch. If not, it will either infinitely expand or infinitely expand but slow down as it expands. And the pull of gravity, as we know, distorts space itself, as we know from general relativity. So the pull of space is going to be distorted by how much gravity there is, and that will affect the overall shape of the universe, which is where the geometry kind of comes in. Now let's take a look at this mass density required in order to have the universe expand forever, or slow down, or just expand but stop and reverse itself. Now the density that's required to have the universe expand forever but slow down with time is known as the critical density. This is apparently predicted by the inflationary theory that the actual density in our universe is the same as the critical density. That's the prediction made by inflationary theory, though I don't quite understand how, so I'm not going to go into trying to explain something I don't know how it works. So, according to inflation, which seems to be a very accurate model of describing the expansion of the early universe, the universe's overall geometry seems to allow this sort of expansion to occur. And it seems to have the most desirable end effect, which is just the heat death of the universe, which is not good, but it seems more pleasant than the other two, which I'll go over. But what geometry is the one that will allow this universe to expand forever, but slow down with time? Well, if we think back to high school, it's Euclidean geometry, the one we all know and love. Euclidean geometry seems to be the best description for the universe if it is going to expand forever but slow down with time. So that's the shape of our universe if the prediction made by inflationary theory is correct. Now, unfortunately, right now, observation seems to tell us a little bit different story. It seems to say that the total mass of the universe is substantially less than the critical density, by about half of what the critical density should be to about three-quarters of what the critical density should be. Now, granted, we haven't discovered all of the matter in our universe, so this number is subject to change. However, if we were to assume that this was true, that we really had half of the critical density, what would happen to our universe? What would be the best geometry to describe it? The answer here is hyperbolic geometry. Let's contrast this with the elliptical geometry really quickly. In elliptical geometry, the universe would have more than enough mass, because the gravity would exert a pull on space so strong that the universe would simply curve back on itself due to the strength of gravity. That is, in elliptical geometry, the whole universe is kind of shaped like a big ball. The expanse of space is not infinite, but you can never reach the end of space because you would just go in a big circle if you were to run towards the end of it. It would curve back on itself. So we would get an expansion, but then gravity would be so strong that it would just collapse in on itself if we were to have elliptical geometry, which doesn't seem to be the case. But again, it's always an option because we haven't seen all the matter in the universe yet, haven't observed all the mass. So in elliptical geometry, space is curved back on itself due to the strength of gravity. In hyperbolic geometry, by contrast, there's simply not enough mass to do this. Space isn't curved back on itself. In fact, it curves away from itself. We would get infinite expansion if this were true. So in hyperbolic geometry, space is kind of starts off. Imagine those two parallel lines again. If we had two galaxies, say, and they were moved forward on this geometry, they would start out close and then get infinitely far away from each other. So that's what would happen in hyperbolic geometry. We would get an infinite expansion, but what would this say about our universe? How would we kind of end up in the very end of the universe? There are a few scenarios, but one of them is known as the Big Rip. In this scenario, all of the matter becomes so dispersed that it's simply just torn apart by the expansion of the universe itself. Imagine even at the very end, if we would have atoms circling around one another, they would get pulled apart. The electrons and the protons would all just be ripped apart by this massive expansion of the universe. There wouldn't be enough to keep them together, not enough force to keep them together versus the expansion of the universe. Everything would be pulled apart and nothing would remain except the very basic elementary particles, which of course can't be broken down anymore. So that's just the Big Rip scenario. However, there's also another, also unpleasant scenario, known as the Big Freeze. In this scenario, as the universe expands, it becomes cooler and heads towards absolute zero. And eventually, taking this to its logical extreme, eventually things would get too cold for human beings to exist and all other life to exist in the universe. Now, note that the universe is expanding right now and is also cooling down towards absolute zero. If we look at our cosmic background radiation, it has cooled a lot from the initial temperature that was present in the Big Bang. So even if the geometry were Euclidean, which we think it is, the universe could still experience a Big Freeze. Now, while hypothesizing about what might happen to the universe at the very end of time is interesting, the fact is, sad fact is, we simply don't have enough information about the universe as a whole to tell us what will definitively happen. However, what we can see from this exercise is how intricately geometry is tied in with the fate of our universe. So in conclusion, there are three different types of geometries. There are three different geometries, two of which are non-Euclidean, one of which is Euclidean geometry. All have different effects on the evolution of our universe. It's predicted that the geometry we are most familiar with, Euclidean geometry, will end up being the one that correctly describes our universe. And this prediction is from inflationary theory. I don't know the exact details, but if you do know them, please let me know. I'll go over to the next show or whenever I get the information, or I'll try to find it out myself. Observation, however, seems to support an infinite expansion that works with hyperbolic geometry because we simply don't see enough matter right now in the universe to match with this critical density we would need to have the expansion we would need for Euclidean geometry. So we have less than that, so we expect hyperbolic geometry to be the overall geometry of our universe if, now this is a big if, assuming that our observations have accounted for all the matter in the universe. But since the big if is, if we have, we probably haven't seen all the matter in the universe yet, so this notion of a hyperbolic geometry being the final geometry is obviously subject to change. So that's this week's episode. Next week, I'll hopefully touch on the book, Creationism's Trojan Horse. If I can get it from the library. I returned it a while ago, and now I gotta try and get it back. I don't think anyone's gonna borrow it, so if no one has borrowed it, I will rent from the library and talk about that. And if not, or even if I do go over the book, Creationism's Trojan Horse, please send me some emails. Let me know what you'd like to hear on the show. I've already gotten some great ideas so far, but if there are any more you guys want to throw out that you know or that you just want me to talk about, I'd be more than happy to do so. So, until next week, I guess, have a great week, and we will talk next time.